I'm Clint Emerson, and welcome to Season 2 of Can You Survive This Podcast, where the interview is just as dangerous as the scenarios I put my guests through. From hostage situations to natural disasters, carjackings, active shooters, and more, if you're looking for the skills necessary to survive these situations, then this is the show for you. Hey, what's up, everyone? This is Clint, and thank you for listening to another episode of Can You Survive This Podcast? We are doing a compilation of the greatest hits, if you will, of the past. And we thought, hey, why not give you a taste of the best interviews you may have missed, the best survival stories and tips you may not have paid attention to last time? So hold on and get ready for Can You Survive This Podcast's greatest hits. Enjoy. And one of the most common questions I get all the time, I've been actually reading your comments. I'm not really good at it, but I have been doing it from time to time. And it's always like, hey, where do I get that t-shirt you're wearing? And I'm always like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Just go look at my links. ViolentNomad.com. The one I'm wearing today is a navy blue blank with some gold and white navy attributions. And if the pirate in you wants a shirt like this, then just go on over to violentnomad.com and get yourself the Buccaneer. Okay, so all the shirts I ever wear is from violentnomad.com, which is my own apparel. Just like everybody else on the planet, your body is your billboard, and I wear my shit all the time. So if you like it, get yourself one. That answers at least, you know, those 100 questions about what shirt I'm wearing, which I think is crazy. But let's get to today's guest.
Go and say from SEAL Team 1. It was very highly disciplined SEAL Team. Training was very strong, very effective. I went to war at SEAL Team 1, loved it, learned a lot there, and that qualified me and caused me to perform very well in selection for the Tier 1 level, the dev group. So I've got nothing but respect there, but the budgets are so radically different. You know, you're talking a budget that's larger at a Tier 1 unit than all the other SEAL teams combined.
Right.
As far as annual budget. So there's no comparison. Instead of having, one support person for every 10 or 15 operators in the team, you've got five support personnel for every operator.
Yeah.
It's a radically different environment. So you're given a lot more responsibility and no excuse for failure. Basically, anything that you think you need as an operator to prepare for an operation can be made available to you if within reason, but I mean, some of it's pretty big stuff.
Yeah.
You have no excuse for failure. It's on you. Big boy rules. And the physical demands are greater. The responsibility is inherently larger. And so going from what I call a regular SEAL team from SEAL Team 1 to Dev Group, riding around in a 6x, an old Vietnam era 6x, you know, is one thing, or in a minivan, or riding around in nice rental cars because you've got sniper rifles that, you know, will only fit in certain trunks and you have to be able to lock them up at certain places. And you're staying in hotel rooms instead of barracks on bases. Yeah. It's just a different budget and you're able to live differently. It's much more of a civilian life, only you're doing super crazy spec op stuff at night, you know. Won't jump out of something at 35,000 feet in one case with the full combat equipment and O2 and all that kind of stuff. And it's a different life. It's a lot greater stress and responsibility, but the assets are overwhelming. And it's like reading a novel, like a crazy adventure novel. And you're looking at each other going, my God, we're living this.
I mean,
this is our lives. If only people knew. And so if you have discipline about you, you don't ever write about it. And you just file that away and like, okay, we got, we had a heck of a life here, man. Let's make sure we got good health care afterward and try to make the best of the years that are left. Right. And have some fun with it. So that's why,
I think
it's a different flavor of life there.
Right. Yeah. I think you nailed it with money. Right. I know that my experience, you'd go from what now they call the theater level, you know, the regular, what we call regular teams, it's theater level to, you know, national level. And money was the big differentiator. Money allows each guy to be truly a professional soldier. You can go and be the master of whatever you want, because there is no one that's going to tell you no, as long as whatever you're deciding to go train with, train, you know, for, whatever it is, they will let you go do that. And they will let you spend that money all day long if it's going to make you better at your job at the end of the day. And then the support that you mentioned, it's phenomenal. You can't, I used to tell people, it's like, you're a rock star without the paycheck, because you're traveling. Awesome. You're getting to do all kinds of cool shit that most people pay to do. We're getting paid to do it. And you've got that support system in place that gives you that time to then professionalize the other things that are more important, you know, like being a shooter or whatever your job is, being a breacher. You know, if you want to be the most badass dude at combatives, you can do it there, because they're going to send you to Brazil and train with the people who invented jiu-jitsu. You know, they're going to send you wherever you want to make you the badass that you should be. At the end of the day, that's exactly how it should be for every, you know, unit. But that's just not the case, because it boils down to, like you said, money, 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 money.
Yeah, I like the way you put it, theater level versus national level. That's a simple and concise way to put it.
Yeah, that's kind of new. As I was getting out, that was the terminology. And it makes sense. For those listening, you know, the SEAL teams used to be broken up regionally into different theaters. Now they all go everywhere. But the theater level, you know, usually working for GCC, or, you know, you usually have a general or an admiral in charge of an area, and that area is called a theater. Therefore, when you deploy, you work for that person. Whereas at the national level, you work for the president or the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, is really the short command structure there. But anyway, I love everything you said, and it's so accurate. I was like, so how did the Prince Harry thing come about with you? And you told me an interesting story, how you guys first met. You're at a close air support school. You were sitting in the back, and he comes walking in, and, you know, it was kind of hush hush, and you were kind of like, eh, fuck off. And then you became good friends, right?
Yeah, it was similar. I probably didn't say fuck off, but yeah, it wasn't far from it. I was on a JTAC. We're on the JTAC course. And this was before his first tour to Afghanistan. So his commanding officer took a risk, said, look, you can't just come to Afghanistan. You need a job title to go away, do the FAC course, and then you can be the regimental FAC. So that's how he was on that course. But we, you know, this course is like a little hut at the end of the runway on an Air Force base. The Air Force don't even care about the Army. But on this, you can imagine this day, every man and his dog turned up for the opening address just to get some face time.
Right.
So there was 18 of us on course. There was four SF students, two from the SAS and SBS. And we sort of commandeered the back of the room, as we do.
Yeah.
And everyone did their opening address. Harry then left the room. Then we were told, look, you know, you treat him like one of your own. He doesn't get any sort of preferential treatment. Is that funny? So he comes back in, and then the first lecture is call signs. So on the course, you're jackpot 1 to jackpot 1-8. So the pilot knows which student he's talking to. And then when you get to your units, you have your own prefix, you know. So like for the SBS, we're Mayhem, you know, SES is Widow Maker. So Harry puts his hand up and he said, you know, if successful on this course, do I get my own call sign? And I just blurted out, yeah, you're Fox Piss 1. Under my breath, and you could see sort of everyone's face like, how dare you? I mean, he turned around, smiled, but then the sergeant major then came in that afternoon. He said, right, I've randomly picked these jackpot numbers. You'll be working with me, and the rest will be with color sergeant, whoever. So there's 18 on course. He randomly picked four. One was me, one was the SES guy, an RAF officer, and Harry. And I was all, he randomly picked them four. And then the other 14 went over to the other group. I was like, yeah, this is obviously, you know, he just wanted his own little group. But then you then get paired off again, you know, so you then work in pairs. So him and I worked together. And like I said, he didn't get any preferential treatment. You know, he's a great operator, you know, very confident, clear on the net. You know what I mean? So he was good, mate. He was good. And they knew that just sticking with that SBS guy, he's not going to give him any preferential treatment.
Yeah. So
And I think, you know, I always say, you know, a lot of people ask him about in the military, you know, that's probably the closest he could be to a normal civilian.
Yeah.
Or, you know, not doing his job, not being scrutinized by the media or whatever. He could be, you know, at that point, he was second lieutenant of Wales, you know what I mean, rather than Prince Harry. So,
yeah, I'm sure he, yeah. I got to assume that he loved every minute of it. For that reason, you know, he's just kind of with the guys doing guys stuff and not having to worry about all that other bullshit. You know, I can imagine
exactly,
it's like a vacation for him, even though it was a full-time job being a military officer and representing the royalty properly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's not in line to be king. So unlike his brother, he had the option. He could go to war. You know what I mean? So, and you know, he did two tours of Afghanistan. So, hats off to him.
Yeah. And so, well, you ended up going to the wedding. I know I've seen pictures, and we're going to use that picture to advertise you, of course. Like, we're going to exploit the shit out. In fact, I'm going to talk to the producers. We're just going to put a picture of Prince Harry and then put Dean Stott on the page. Yeah. How's that?
Yeah. Well, that's the problem. As we discussed at the beginning of this show, it doesn't matter how many world records you got, how many millions you've raised for charity. Yeah. I did get to mention, we raised $1.3 billion for mental health as well.
Damn,
in the process of that fly ride. It's all about, I'm just known as Prince Harry's Special Forces friends. You know, I've been called a lot worse in my time, so I'll take it.
Yeah, it's not a bad association, I'd guess. And now, I mean, hell, he's like, I think, where does he live? He's living there in LA or he's in Canada? I hear a different.
No, he's up the road in Montecito. Yeah, just outside of LA.
Yeah, that's right. That's pretty cool. Well, I won't dig any more on that just because everybody else is, even though they're like, no, ask him more questions about that time when he got naked and they took pictures of him on a balcony. But we'll just stay away from it.
I wasn't there, so I can't comment.
You were the one taking the pictures, I'm sure.
Yeah.
What about helicopters versus fixed wing?
I had a couple stall in mid-flight and at the nighttime in Afghanistan, which is definitely scary. It's like, okay, now we're going to die in this.
Right.
But
hint. I always meant bring up the whistling shit cans of death.
Yeah.
Right? That's helicopter.
There's 46, dude.
Yeah. Right. Dude,
what's did you wrong? Just die?
Yeah, you know where I
was. This is Spec Ops bird, man. What are these techs doing?
What is going on?
Freaking mechanics.
Yeah, we had one. It was a training gig, and it was a 47. And
I'm sorry, 47. That's what I said.
Yeah, 47. And it was the Chocolate Mountains in Nevada. Right. And it was at Fallon. I forgot what the hell we were doing out there. And we were flying to come back one night and the pilots couldn't get over the mountain range because of the winds. So it would come up. And I mean, you're looking down, you can see the top of a mountain, you know, the deal,
five feet
away. Yeah. And it's like, and it was pushing into the wind and would not get over the mountain. So he would turn left, bank right. And of course, the winds would catch those props and push you down. If it was like this, it was the craziest roller coaster. Yeah.
Dude.
And then he would try again and try again. And we're over comms going, are we at the lowest point? I mean, what are you doing? Are you aiming for the highest?
Are you a pilot?
And anyway, we finally got over that night. But you're thinking about, well, if we run out of gas,
we're going to use the wheels and just kind of off-road this over the mountaintop real quick.
Yeah. Yeah. We were debating. It was like, okay, we're just going to camp. He's going to land and we're going to camp out and wait for the winds to die down. It's like, it was insane. Dude. But it was those moments on helicopters when you think,
I'd probably support that decision.
Now we're going to die.
Yeah. We'll just go to sleep. It's fine. It's
just
fine.
Land and it's camp good. Out. It's us.
I've got food.
That's right.
Okay, so you're the new UAV pilot. Throw it up. Let's see what you got. And I threw it up and I crashed it. And that was the end of my career with UAVs.
Perfect. I'm sure you did that on purpose.
Totally.
Yeah, I would too. It's like, fuck this, man. Those things don't really, it's like 1 out of 10 times you throw them, they actually do what they're supposed to.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're like a serious drone, like a legitimate pilot flying those real deal ones.
Yeah.
I mean, those weak ones that we had, the Raven A's and B's, they were just like.
They always nosedive. Mm-hmm. I saw it happen time and time again with us too. It's like, what the fuck is the purpose?
None.
But there is times when it works. Like I remember we were taken down. It was actually like a huge post office or, you know, mailing center of sorts. And like, you know, Intel was like, hey, Fedayeen, there are a bunch of them there and they're storing a lot of weapons and rockets and all this crap there. And it was right near a railroad, you know? And so it was kind of in the middle of nowhere. It was on the outskirts of, I don't even remember which city, like Anasuri or something. And we got that drone up and it actually took off first throw, got it up, got it orbiting.
That's impressive in itself.
It had the IR, the thermal payload on, or whatever the hell it had, and it actually got great video of us moving in, take down, and then we set charges and just blew the whole fucking thing up when we left, you know. And got it. It was the only video that actually we got out of all the other attempts to try and get cool shit on video. That was the only one. It looked really cool. It reminded me of what was that scene, one of the Tom Clancy movies where the SAS guys were moving across the desert to hit a terrorist camp. It was when he was going after more like IRA type terrorists.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? And remember that? I don't know if you watched that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It looked just like that. It kind of reminded me of it because we had comms flowing through it and it all sounded cool. Now, hell, I don't even know where the video went at this point. I remember hanging on to it for a long time and then it got lost in the mix.
We never had that.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably a good thing.
It's because I was the pilot.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There you go. And the Epstein isn't dead comment, right?
No, didn't kill himself. Yeah,
that's right. Epstein didn't kill himself. And so now, you know, here we are, what, a year or more later?
Yeah.
Give or take. And now you've got, what's her name?
Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yeah, there you go. Maxwell. Right. Now she's been tried. And so what are your thoughts these days on any of that?
I'm actually kind of surprised that she was found guilty. I mean, it's without a doubt encouraging to see that. I think that whole ring of fucking people, now that she's been convicted, I think there should be like a further investigation into all of her contacts and they should get fried, honestly. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I know Bill Clinton's fucking one of them. Bill Gates fucking, I mean, there's a bunch of people that were in that web of fucking nasty shit that are still just walking around completely unimpeded. And I don't understand that, you know.
Yeah.
So even if it was like a plea deal and maybe they offered that and she turned it down, I mean, who knows? But, you know, to me, I would use that if I was a prosecutor as leverage against her. I'd try to squeeze her and say, hey, you can go to jail for the rest of your life where you can turn these fucking scumbags and get it reduced or even washed if you get enough of them, you know. So we'll see if that happens. But, you know, like I said, I'm at least encouraged to see that, you know, she didn't kill herself in prison, you know, or wasn't offed, you know, by a fucking auto accident or whatever, you know. So it's good to see that. I hope more comes from it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm surprised that, you know, someone that's been living the lifestyle that she's been living wasn't like begging to give up names,
yeah,
just so she could maintain her freedom and her lifestyle. You know, it's like it blows me away.
Yeah,
and she didn't give anything up early on and just prevent the trial to begin with.
Yeah, no, I know.
When the war kicked off, we went out onto ships and were operating by helo, blowing up mines that were threatening the Allied ships. And, you know, literally physically dropping in and rigging those up with explosives and blow, you know, getting swimming back away, bringing horse collar down from the bird, pulling back up into the helicopter, standing off and letting the time fuse ignite that mine.
That's great, awesome. That's old school frogman shit. Yeah,
it was. And of course, when the captains of the ships would find out that we just blew a couple mines in their ship's path that day, they would feed us steak and lobster, me and my buddy Dino. And Dino and I worked together throughout that campaign at Team One. And that was satisfying work. And then we captured the first prisoners of that war on islands and on oil rigs and sinking ships. You know, there was one time where there was an oil tanker that was modified with a bunch of weapons systems, Iraqi tanker. And they were shooting at the fast movers, the Allied fast movers on their inbound bombing runs toward Baghdad. And so they called us in. And when we flew in helicopters, the sky was black. So there was a ceiling at only several hundred feet. And we had to fly under that. It was strange, man, like a black blanket across the sky.
Yeah, just Saddam lit all the refineries, you name it. He lit everything on fire, right?
Yeah. But in this case, it was a ship that was burning. And so all this blackness was coming from one ship and the ship's back was broken and it was slowly sinking. And so we dropped down below that black cloud layer was flying beneath that test fire in our M4, our M14s. Most of us at Team One, we preferred carrying 7.62. So in those days, it was either an M4 or an M14. So we were carrying 14s. Test firing those things. Dunk, dunk, dunk. Okay, we're good. Make sure everything's ready to go. And then dropping into the water and swimming up, and these guys jumping over to the sides of the ship, and we were capturing them. You know, Dino, I'd pull my pistol out. Dino would grab them around the head with a knife, and I would holster up my pistol and search the guy and zip tie his hands in the front and pull him away from the others and pull the horse collar down and send him up. That's how we started capturing these guys. And
wow,
it was interesting, you know, like right in their face kind of stuff. And yeah. One guy, it got a little sporty. He was on an overturned wooden lifeboat, white wooden lifeboat. He didn't have his shoes on. He had this big life preserver on. And Dino was waving at him to get off the lifeboat, and he wouldn't. And come to, you know, find out later, he was just scared. But Sam opened up and raked him with water from the M60 from the helicopter. He just kicked the door gunner off for a second, went boom, 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 and just gave the guy some incentive, like, get off the damn boat. And when the guy fell over, Dino grabbed him, and I swam up to start searching him. And I went to go lower myself in the water to start searching his legs, and he threw his legs around me, clamped down with like a, almost like a jiu-jitsu fighter was like locked around me.
Yeah, I got you into the guard.
Oh, no, dude, no. Yeah. So I just relax, and I slid down, and I pull up my knife from my leg. I had a dive knife on my leg, a skeletonized little Tecna knife.
Yeah, yeah.
I came up with that, and I put it right up under his gut, and I came up out of the water and grabbed him like, dude, I've got you. I can split you from nuts to neck, or you can throw your legs off of me, which it's going to be. And he relaxed his legs, and I threw him off of me, and he stayed calm. And I kind of like, don't let that happen again. I put it back away, and we were fine, you know? And so we processed him later. He was a little bit of a problem in the bird, and I ended up basically taping him up almost mummy style. But that was interesting. I never thought I'd be, need underwater hand-to-hand skills, if you will. I mean, it was
you did an underwater combat fighting. Look at you.
To a mild degree. I mean, I'd already had his hand zip tied in the front, so it wasn't full on. But I mean, if I didn't know what I was doing, he could have drowned me, because he just clamped his legs around me as hard as he could.
Wow.
But he's really, he was trying to get his head above water,
right?
So I just told I said Dino, raise his head a little more.
Yeah, he's drowning.
Guy raised his head in the morning. That's when he settled down. So I'm like, okay, he's just scared.
You're listening to Can You Survive This podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Please make sure to subscribe, rate, and share on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite shows.
What's the most dangerous situation you feel like you've ever been in?
Military or just in general?
Yeah, just in general. Yeah. Mainly where you've had a lot of lessons learned come out of it, where you're like, whoa, man, wish I would have done this, you know?
Yeah, there's one actually, and it's in the prologue and epilogue of my book. It's, you know, so when I was in Afghanistan, we used to work with the, you know, Secret Service, and we used to go pick up Taliban agents. So I used to dress up as a local Taliban and drive into Kandahar and go pick up these agents. So we would do this day in, day out. There's no point in us planning a route, because every day, you know, when you go into the city, there'd be roadblocks, there'd be situations. So we knew where we were going, and we just had to get there. And what would happen is I'd normally lead vehicle. Me and one of the Afghan SF guys would be in the front of me. You know, we would drive by the target, second vehicle would pick up the target, third would make sure we got no follow-up. You know, those are our normal SOP without giving too much away. So we do this day in, day out. This one day we went into town, the road that we initially wanted to take was blocked. So I then got diverted to right, and it was just bumper to bumper traffic. And I just remember people, it was a very narrow market street. There's people walking down the sides of the vehicles. And the people were tapping on the window and talking to me. And I would always direct them to Hekmat, and he would do the talking. But there was a lot of attention. I don't like anything in my eyes. So I had a nice big black beard, no tan skin, turban, looked the part, but a big beaming blue eyes. So initially I thought, you know, I've been compromised.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I said to the heck man, I think we've been compromised. You know, it came up over the net, so it just goes radio silent. So in my head, I'm thinking, you know, the worst case scenario, as you do, orange boiler suit, CNN tonight, 9 o'clock news, this guy. So in my head, I'm thinking about the IA drill, immediate action drill, what I need to do. Obviously, I can't divulge that on this show. So, you know, I'm thinking about that. And the initial thing is to grab the weapon under my seat, which is a MP5 Kurtz. So it's got no barrel. And you just empty the magazine 30 rounds into the windscreen. Gives yourself time to grab your weapon and then get on your flip-flops and start heading back to camp, which was about 18 miles as the crow flies from this point. So here's me in my head, you know, going over this situation, you know, planning it out. And just as I was about, you know, during this whole situation, the vehicles are slowly edging forward. So HQ said, on your call, you make the decision. So, okay, as I was just about to grab it, the second vehicle come by around the corner, and my friend Ads, he came up over the net and he's like, stop. So straight away you just drop everything, you know, your whole body just freezes, and I'll drop the weapon, and he says, your turban's caught in the door. So for me it was like a real life lesson how I misread a situation, but I knew I shouldn't have been there. My senses were so heightened, thinking the worst case scenario, when in fact people have been genuinely nice and trying to help me. So that's a real life lesson for me. And in the fact, you know, there wasn't any explosions. It wasn't any shooting. It was just, you know, and I always say it when I do lectures on security and things like that, you know, don't run into a situation. Just step back, have a look. And that's what I didn't do. I was so immersed in it. And I knew that I shouldn't be there. So my senses were heightened. So I wasn't making the right decisions.
I love that story because it supports what I put in the first little book I ever did was Escape the Wolf. And it's an awareness book. And in there, I would talk about, like, anytime you arrive into a new area, new country, you're going to be oversensitized. Your brain and everything is going to be trying to pay attention to everything because everything in front of you is new. And you're going to think that everything is after you, right? You're going to see ghosts. You're going to see goblins. You're going to see everything that you think you can see. In that environment, when the reality is it's nothing, it's just a new culture, a new place. So you got to almost step back from all of that temporary paranoia, you know, which and just kind of drive forward, but keep your wits about you at the same time. But man, that's a fucking great example of what I've talked about in there. You know, I was in an unfortunate leadership position, and the comms guy that we had, right, he was the primary. And, you know, we're in the middle of, you know, basically starting a war and pushing up Highway 1 in Iraq. And he was just, I can't remember what he was doing, but he just wasn't doing his job. So we like fired him on the spot. We're like, all right, you're fucking done. You were the secondary comms guy. And were you a new guy?
I was.
Your first deployment was pushing into Iraq.
Yeah.
Fuck. Yeah, I forget about that, you lucky little fucker. So first deployment, you're pushing into Iraq, you're a new guy, and now we're, just a couple of days in, the primary comms guy just wasn't making comms, you know, and keep in mind, for those listening, you're surrounded by, you know, other U.S. forces when you're, you know, basically pushing into a country, and it was probably the closest thing to, I hate to compare things to like World War II, but it was really the closest thing because it's not like we were going back each night to an FOB and, you know, getting Starbucks and getting a good night's rest, or, you know, had weight rooms or flat screens, you know, in our little, you know, platoon spaces. We were sleeping underneath our vehicles every night. And in some aspects, it was very much just, you know, very rogue, maverick lifestyle, cruising the Iraqi countryside, doing what we were told. But so, it's important to kind of note that, because that lends to how important it is that a comms guy do his job, because there's no like, hey, I need this radio fixed, or we need to go pick up extra batteries, or there's no excuses. There was no excuses. We had to make comms with the Marines and other forces so that essentially they when we rolled into different areas, they didn't shoot at us, right? I mean, is that the extent of it?
Yeah, I mean, you remember that. I mean, some of the biggest threats, to be quite honest, were friendly, you know, blue-on-blue events, because it was so chaotic, right? There's people, units, conventional units, you know, special operations folks running all over the place doing, you know, kind of all these different things. And I don't know that we realized that the major oversight in regards to communications and how, like, the, you know, different systems that the Marines use, vice the Navy, vice Army. I mean, it was very dynamic, right? Situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, the main comms guy couldn't figure it out. And then so you got put in the position and you started figuring it out. And what was the big thing? It was like crypto, right? Like we're running different crypto or?
Well, in particular with the Marines, we eventually, out of Baghdad, got attached to the Marines because we provided that we were able to move forward of the line of the front, right? Remember, and we were doing some recce, some bridges that they wanted info on so they could move their heavy vehicles.
That's right.
And so, but the problem was we just had the same radios, but they were utilizing, I believe, SINGARs or something. And I mean, we were I think at the time we were the only ones in country with like a 25K dedicated satellite, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
So I forgot about that. Yeah. We were pretty lucky. We had dedicated satellite and then we were expecting everyone else to probably kind of be on the same sheet of music with us. Right.
Yeah. I don't know what we thought was going to happen, but you know, once we realized like, wow, we really need to figure this out. I went and spent quite a bit of time with the Marines, to figure out how they run on SINGARs. Cause certainly, we couldn't have fit all them on our satellite, right? And so for us to flex to, and they were a much bigger unit than we were.
Yeah.
So for us to flex to their, you know, comms architecture was way easier than the other way around.
Right. Okay. That's a good refresher. SINGARs. I don't think I've heard that since the time you were sitting next to me in the fucking Humvee going, hey, they're on SINGARs. I'm like, well, I don't know what is that? It's like, just figure it out.
Yeah.
And of course you figured it out and got us back up and running again. And the other guy was all mad for the rest of the deployment. But hey, you don't do your job, you get fired, and there's something to learn from that. Okay. So, yeah, the other thing that you just refreshed my mind on was the how small a world it really, like the General Kelly aspect of it. I mean, remember we were working for a Colonel Kelly in Iraq, you know, and here's a guy that became a general, obviously became a very popular general, and then worked under Trump. Trump eventually fired all his Marine generals, but you know, Kelly, obviously a very stand-up guy, and I thought he was kind of cool, the limited interaction we had with him on the battlefield. And he was also the first, pretty sure he was the first flag officer to be promoted from colonel to general in combat since like the Korean War or something. It was really, super cool, like kind of, you know, obviously a small world of all of us on the ground, and then for him to kind of escalate all the way up to the positions he's held since then, it's pretty cool. But we met him, you know, with gunfire going around, and here's this dude, this Marine officer standing there like, hey guys, I'm glad you're here, we really could use your help, there's some bad guys over there, we need you to go kill them. And he shook all our hands, he looked us all in the eyes, and he turned around and walked away. And it was like, whoa, you know, you wouldn't find a SEAL officer of that rank hanging out like in gunfire like that. You know what I mean? It was just really surreal, wasn't it?
Where was that? That you see, these are the memories you know better than I do.
This was just south of An-Nasiriyah.
Okay.
Yeah. Jessica Lynch was held up in that hospital.
Yeah.
And we had just rolled in, and yeah, he came out and he said his 2 cents to us. And he was the one that was basically like, there's a town over there called Suckass. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but we've been calling it Suckass, population 80,000. And well, anyway, we need you guys to go over there and kill everybody.
Well, I remember that actually. We went over to that bridge. We ended up blowing up some technical vehicles, you know, right? Remember that?
We blew up some vehicles
and stuff over there and found a cache under the bridge of RPGs or something, mortars.
Right.
Something blew all that up too.
Yeah. And there was like used rubbers laying there. We're like, wonder if they were, if these soldiers were just banging each other or what? Because remember, it was like RPGs and a bunch of used rubbers. And they had just like, you could tell they had just must have saw us coming and ran away, you know, or
yeah,
right. It was something kind of strange.
They even like wrecked their, you know, kind of trashed their vehicle or wrecked their vehicle when they're trying to back up and it got stuck or something. They just left it and so we blew it up.
Yeah, we blew it up. That was pretty funny. Just running around blowing shit up. That was cool. We will be right back after the break. You've survived a lot of stuff, but it's that time in the podcast where we have to see if you survive this podcast. And it starts with this little hypothetical scenario. Are you ready? Do you think you can
stand by?
I think you'll do just fine, but it's important to note that the only right answer is the answers on my piece of paper here, okay?
Oh, okay,
just so
nice.
You know.
That's cool.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to kick this thing off. So the scary, suspenseful music will start right about now. The police ask if they can come in and ask you some questions. So A, let them in, or B, tell them to come back with a warrant and shut the door. You're in someone else's country, so
yeah
it's a tough one.
If there was a third option, I'd ask if we could go into the public lobby and just chat there.
It's a great point. Yep.
Again, they're not going to come back with a warrant. I've worked in some of these places, you know, to, you know, yeah. Again, try and I'll go with the A.
Yeah,
let them in.
And yes, A is correct. And I'm with you because you and I both know the legal systems really only work in 1, 2, maybe 3 countries on this fucking planet.
The rest, it's
corrupt. I mean, it's corrupt. It's semi-permissive if you're lucky. And the law enforcement certainly... bribery and taking cash and all that is like a primary form of income for these folks, right?
Yeah, true. I sort of learned as well, especially like going around, because I worked all over Africa and the Middle East, is that the laws that we have in UK and America are for UK and America. You can't enforce them in another country.
Yeah.
So people used to ask me questions about buying weapons on the black market. It's legal. I've done nothing illegal there. You know, it's all legal in that country.
If I
did it in the UK, it'd be totally illegal.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you need to understand, and as you touched on, before you go to these countries, you understand their cultures, their laws and things like that. So you don't get tripped up as well. And you understand that is normal. Is it normal in the US and it isn't normal in the UK, but it is normal in wherever we are.
Right. In those countries, you know, they don't call them black markets. They're called open air markets. You walk up and you buy whatever the fuck you want.
It's or the not hotel until, manager.
It's not until you leave the country, you go, oh, yeah, those, I guess, were considered black markets. But they're just open air markets. They're like a souk. A souk of weapons. I'm with you, man. That's good stuff. So you let them in. All right. They tell you that they need your passport. Okay. This is where, you know, this is the part that bugs me even in real life. You know, anybody who needs my passport. So they say, hey, we need your passport and you got to come with us. And so do you A, refuse and request to call your embassy, or B, cooperate with the police and go ahead and, you know, give them your passport?
So what I always do, and I do it when I do my travel security to people. Before I go anywhere, I take photocopies of my passport. I take photocopies of my yellow fever cards and things like that. So when you have, when people ask you, especially some of these hotels you go to around the world, oh, we need to take your passport to get it scanned. Well, here, I've already got a photocopy. So that should do the job. So you never lose sight of your passport. So that was what I would do in this situation.
Yeah.
I keep my passport on me, but I would give them my photocopy, because then you've actually agreed to what they've asked.
Yep.
You've given them what they need.
Yep.
Without upsetting them. So I always have photocopies for those scenarios.
Yeah. Okay. I like it. And that's all great points. And I think it's stuff that even if you go to the statedepartment.gov here in the United States, yeah. You go there, it's going to tell you all these things. It really does. It's a great source. You know, another great source of information is if you're going to, let's say, whatever that country is, go to that country's embassy websites. Every single one of them have embassy websites now. We tend to go, oh, I'm just going to look at American stuff, even though I'm traveling to Egypt. It's like, no, go to the Egyptian consulate website, and they will tell you exactly what you, the do's and don'ts, which it's a much better source of information. So, yeah, that's good stuff. While you're in the bathroom, you hear shots fired. Automatic gunfire rains out, okay? The party is being taken hostage by several gunmen. So you're in the elevator, and now you hear people in the hallways say, did someone just get in the elevator? So do you, A, take the elevator down to the lobby, or B, take the elevator to a different floor and look for more discreet exits? You already kind of answered this.
Hey.
Yeah, hey. Look at you.
And I would also probably use the elevator and press a few of the buttons to make sure they wouldn't know what level I got out on. So I could press it down to the one below, but then maybe I'd stay in and then go a couple more below and then see if the door to the stairwell is open.
Right. False insertions, we call that. Right, because bad guys used to hear us with our helicopters. So you make sure you go land your helicopter about five times in five different locations, and they don't know which location we actually got out of the helicopter. Right?
Yeah.
So yeah, you want to hit all the buttons. That's a great idea. Okay. Good job. So you grab an object in this renovated cubicle area, and you throw it to make a noise and distract the gunman. When he turns towards the sound, now you charge him. Okay, now you're going full-on violent mode. You take him out with a screwdriver straight to the fucking throat. Damn, so cool. Yeah. And now he's lying on the ground. Now you have his gun, okay, and his walkie-talkie. Do you, A, take his gun back to the 11th floor and save everyone, or B, check through all the channels on the bad guy's radio, his walkie-talkie, to see if you can connect with any of the police radio frequencies that are out there?
If it was a video game, I'd definitely go B.
Yeah, why not, right? Because intel, collect information, take that opportunity to see what these guys are up to. Maybe you can figure out all their locations through listening to their comms. And it gives you, without a doubt, a huge advantage. Just like in Die Hard, if you haven't caught on
yet. I've been playing this whole thing through my head.
In Die Hard, you shoot out the windows and you throw the body of your new screwdriver holder out the window. And you hear, and of course he drops right down and lands on top of the cop car. Because you are that good at throwing bodies out from high. Yes, exactly. I mean, you're from Texas, so... And you hear the cop erupt over the radio. And he's like, I need backup at this building right now. Okay. So suddenly it's not so quiet, not so peaceful at this building after a dead body falls on his car. Do you A, now go to the roof and try to communicate with the radio? Or B, hide where you are until the cops come?
I think I would hide because, like you were saying, in the last situation, time, and also you don't know if there are the bad guys in the stairwell and it is so far up. I don't think I would actually get up there in time, and I'm sure I'd see someone along the way. So if there's no one on that floor right now, the bad guys know the cops are here. So I feel like I would stay and hide. Whether I'd hide on that floor or whether or not... Actually, I probably would hide on that floor because I feel like once they know the cops are there, they'll be running up and down the stairway. So I don't think they're going to be safe.
Is that
Oh my gosh, no. Maybe you've got to rethink the answer.
The thing about staying put is that the bad guys could actually come look for their missing buddy. Right.
Yes.
And now you're going to stay exactly where he went missing. And not to mention, eventually they're going to realize he fell on a police car from a window.
Okay.
So you want to get, you've created a new X for yourself, right?
Yeah.
So anytime there's another big incident, like using an automatic weapon to shoot out a window and then throw a body out of it, you've just created a new X for yourself, right? So you need to keep moving. So A, move to the roof so you can get a signal, communicate with the cops, all right? But you only missed one, so you're still surviving the podcast.
Okay,
all right.
I'm still alive.
You're doing okay. You're doing okay.
Okay.
You're getting ready for bed when suddenly everything starts violently shaking. Do you A, lie down next to the sturdy piece of furniture, such as the couch or a table, or go stand in a door frame? Now, this may get you. Some people have heard.
Go things. Stand in a door frame.
Really?
No.
No. It is A.
You stay by the sturdy whole, piece of furniture.
The whole door frame Shit. Thing doesn't really apply. It's a misconception, unfortunately. But you've obviously heard it. I know I'd heard it at one point. But yeah, the door frame is really not providing you any protection.
When you think about it, yeah, it's definitely not as big as my body. The door frame would only cover about this much of my head.
So, that's right. Yeah.
See where you're going.
That's right. So often door frames are not reinforced, but laying down next to something really big and sturdy and is bigger than you, if anything falls, it's going to hit that thing first and not hit you, which is the goal. And you're kind of creating a, if you will, this triangle, you know, yeah. The third piece of the triangle isn't there yet. There's your body, there's the obstacle, and then you're just waiting for whatever else is to fall to create the rest of that triangle. But that's kind of what you're going for. So now you're laying next to this big ass piece of furniture that you've got in your little modest single story. And the initial shaking has stopped, right? So do you A, grab a go bag and supplies, or just run outside?
I grab my go bag and
your go
supplies.
Bag. Yes. We talk about go bags all the time around here. Yes. Go bags are, it's important to have something. It can be a bag. It can be a backpack. It can, you know, something that's always put within arm's reach. You know where it's at. The rest of the family knows where it's at. Because really the leading cause of death in an earthquake is falling debris. That is the reason why you do not want to just go run aimlessly everywhere. Toppling trees, power lines, there's a whole lot of danger outside. So sometimes it's not the best decision, especially after the first big violent shake. So yes, a go bag, it's got, what I always say is put life support items in it. That's, you know, your water, your food, you got bartering systems when crises happen. So, you know, it could be cash, could be gold, or it could be, you know, maybe some first aid stuff. But you get the point. You want that anything that provides survivability. And it's good to plan for about, you know, 72 hours, give or take, because 911 is going to be really busy. You approach the situation at the front of the plane. And the stewardess are telling him to take his seat, and he is refusing to sit down. Okay. So do you A, calmly ask if everything's okay, or B, grab the closest coffee pot and hit the guy with it?
Because I have those metal ones. Those things would not feel good.
They got good ones.
I'm had to go calmly ask because I want to defuse the situation.
De-escalate. Yes, it is absolutely the word of the decade. That's for sure. Let's see what the
B
game
sounds really nice.
B is typical team guy, right? All right, let's see. A, you are correct. You want to calmly, because what have we learned just dealing with clients and stuff? De-escalation. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. If you can.
And if you, the big word here would be calmly. Hey, bro, what's going on here? Like, you're just escalating. You're like, are you yelling at me? Like, hey, bro, is everything okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. The peanuts sucked. I agree with you. Like, just manipulate the situation.
Yeah. One of the acronyms that comes to mind that we came up with at Escape the Wolf for our corporate folks on de-escalation is it is the word calm, C-A-L-M. C, remain calm above everything else. A, start paying attention to what the person is saying, because sometimes people just want to be heard.
Right.
And L is like, listen and lean in, like show them, even if you're faking it, that you actually care about what their problem is.
Yep.
And then M is manage and model. Model being the most important, like act the way that you would want him to act. Mm-hmm. If you start acting
the
like an
rule,
asshole,
baby. There it is again. There it is
so
again.
So calm. If all else fails,
that's
use
good.
The acronym
that's very
calm,
good.
People. And stay calm above everything else if you can't remember what the hell the acronym stands for. Just so people know, I mean, I've talked about this several times. Zip ties, you know, is another but a very fragile ratchet system that can be broken the same way you get out of tape. But if it's the thick, heavy duty ones, then you just got to use a shim of some sort. You know, you hear about bobby pins and other things you can shove in between, you know, the actual ratchet mechanism in the teeth, and it just slips right off. So, you know, you can get out later. All right. No, it didn't stall that time. Okay. They take you outside and they begin to force you into the back seat of their car. It's a little four-door Honda. So do you A, take off running down the street, or B, play it cool and get in the car?
A.
A. So yeah, he's going to go ahead and...
if I'm not going to let him tie me up, I'm sure not going to fucking get in their car either.
But. So yeah, Mike, going with A, he's going to run down the street. The answer is B, play it cool and get in the car. Once again, when you're outnumbered, outgunned, taking severe blows of the head, whatever's going on, sometimes you have to temporarily surrender so you can live another day. The last thing you want to do is get shot in the back or knocked out and then wake up somewhere where you don't know where the fuck you are and with the real restraints in place. You know, it's a Dexter moment. You don't want to be butt naked, wrapped up in, plastic wrap with Dexter cutting your cheek so he can collect your blood and put it on the slide.
Fucking kidneys in an ice bath.
Yeah. But Mike is fighting all the way.
Yeah,
regardless of whether he's
well, not all the way. Like I'd get down initially, I wouldn't fight him. But again, it's so many. Like,
yeah,
you know, let's say not to get too off track, but let's say there's two doors, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you can see this on the camera, but like, let's say I'm at the end of the line, right by one door, and they come in the other door. Like, yeah, I'm just gonna get the fuck out of the door. Yeah,
of course.
You know, I also always have a fucking gun on me. You know, so I would get down and I would slowly pull my gun out, wait for both of them to have their backs turned, and I would shoot both of them.
There you go.
You know, but and I get that, you know, these are a little more 30,000 foot view questions, but. Yeah, like I'm not letting anybody zip tie me, and I'm not getting in anybody's car fucking unwarranted. Like I'm too arrogant of a fucking prick that way. Like I'm just not doing it.
You know, but I'm with you, man. If you can fight and you have the ability, then you should. But there's a lot of people out there that just don't and think they could.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the delineating difference there. Okay, here's one. You'll love this one. Toilet or drawer?
Toilet or drawer?
Yeah. Hell. A toilet or a drawer?
I'm not sure where that's going, but I'll choose drawer.
Drawer. Yes. That's the one. I mean, so, you know, of course, I know you and your wife really well. And I remember her telling me a story about one night where you woke up in the middle of the night. Instead of making it to the toilet, you went ahead and went to the drawer. I think it was like her sock drawer or something. and went ahead and filled the drawer up instead of filling the toilet up.
May have done that.
Were you super tired or had you been drinking or what's your excuse?
I'm sure I had probably been drinking.
Now this leads to the next one. You know, so yeah, you picked the drawer over your wife, which is probably good. Oh no, the toilet. So yeah, now wife or drawer? Which one you go with there? The drawer or the wife?
Jeez. Now I see where this is going.
Because I think you've peed on her too, right?
Oh,
did you pee on her once or twice? You've peed all over her, I think.
I may be guilty of that.
And then, of course, the last one is Clint or drawer.
Oh, here we go. Well, I have to choose Clint at that point.
Yes, because you have peed all over me, too. And that's always a fun story. You have to pull the fun stories out. When Mike was on the show, we had to talk about me digging poop out of his constipated ass. So, of course, we're going to talk about the new story that hopefully will go viral is how Zach likes to pee on Clint. And of course, after he's done peeing all over me in my sleep, he goes and sleeps on the floor and leaves me to lay in the pee for the rest of the night, which was really very friendly of you. Of course, I wake up in the morning, I'm like, how the fuck did I get all wet? And then I look around and you're curled up in the fetal position on the floor. And
I think there was quite a bit of booze involved with that one.
Holy shit. I appreciate you coming on this show. Thank you very much. And like I always say, keep it simple because crisis will complicate the rest. And until next time, be safe out there. Can You Survive This Podcast is a production of Calvary Audio and iHeartMedia. Recorded live from a secure location here in Dallas, Texas. Produced by Brandon Morgan, Jeff Apple, and Clint Emerson.
executive produced by Keegan Rosenberger and Dana Brunetti. For Calvary Audio, I'm Clint Emerson.